Hi, welcome to another episode of Django Chat, podcast on the Django Web Framework. I'm Will Vincent, joined by Carlton Gibson. Hello, Carlton.
Hello, Will.
And we're very pleased to have Nick Giannatakis join us again to speak about web development, Django, and other things. Welcome, Nick.
Hey, thanks a lot for having me.
Yeah, thanks for coming
back. It's fun to be back after, what was it, about 2 years or so?
Yeah, 2 years. So let's see, what last time we talked a bit about Docker and Flask, and you're a really interesting guest because you know Django, but you also work day-to-day now with PHP. You have a lot of experience with Flask. And so I think maybe we'll talk about more generally web deployment and not just narrowly Django as we usually do on this show. But maybe what's changed for you in the last 2 years since we last spoke? I believe you have a full-time job now.
Yeah, so it's been, let's see now, in September 2021 is when I started a full-time position. But yeah, I still do the courses and YouTube videos and blog post stuff on the side.
So how do you, here's my immediate question, how do you have time to do a full-time job and courses on YouTube?
That is a very good question. And there's a reason why new courses haven't been posted in a while. Because, yeah, I mean, when you're working a full-time job, it's like 40 hours, give or take, a week. Like, yeah. And you got to be protective of yourself, just your own time, right? You don't just want to be grinding full-time job and then it's like 10 minutes to eat dinner and then it's like 4 hours of doing courses after. Like, you're going to get burned out doing that all the time.
Yeah, no, entirely.
But for me, I've optimized things to the point now where, you know, I make a new YouTube video usually on the weekend, like every Saturday or Sunday. And honestly, like, it depends on how long the video is, but it's not too bad of a time investment. Let's say maybe 2 hours all in to make, like, I don't know, a 15 or 20 minute video.
Okay, that's fantastic. And you can, well, we may have discussed this before, but what do you use for that? Because I got ScreenFlow going and I think, yeah, okay, that's about right. But there's lots of depth in it. And I'm thinking, always scared to commit to the technology. What do you recommend?
Yep. Right now, because I am using Windows, I do use a tool called Camtasia.
Okay.
And I think there is a port for that to work on macOS as well. Yeah, it's pretty, I don't want to say bare bones, like it has good features, but yeah, I don't know, it's whatever you get used to. Like, I've made like 600 videos now, so it's like I'm familiar with all the widgets.
You're a madman with your productivity. I remember when you were still doing the podcast, I was like, you know, slow down a little there. You're making me feel bad because you were just, you know, week after week for, how many was it that you did? Was it, it wasn't quite 100, I don't think, right? It was like 60 or 70?
Oh, I had to hit the 100 mark. It's like, I did 102 or something. It's definitely 100 plus.
Yes, because we had switched to every other week and then we take breaks and you were just relentless with it. Maybe just to go back, like, what was, so this is the Running in Production podcast, which is fantastic. Lots of things on Django, but other areas. What was, you know, with some time away, how do you look back on, you know, what the good, the bad, like, how do you feel about it now? I mean, you're still doing YouTube videos, so you're not completely burned out from teaching, but, you know, how do you view the podcast experience in hindsight?
I would say if there were infinite time, I would still be doing it for sure. So I don't regret any of it. I don't know. It was awesome because I kind of got a chance to speak to like 100 different people from all different walks of life, right? Someone who just graduated high school, like their first app ever, to like, you know, billion-dollar company type of thing. So it was cool, yeah, just to talk to different people. So I don't like regret the time spent. But yeah, there were certain areas that were just like major burnout-inducing things, as you may know from doing your own podcast.
Well, I think I told you, I mean, having a co-host keeps it going, right? I mean, just to have someone else to the ups, the downs, someone to say, hey, let's do more, let's do less. I think it's anything solo is really hard, especially a podcast, given it's so much kind of hidden work, right? I mean, for an hour long conversation, I think you even said at one point you estimated like 6 or 7 hours total. Or what was your calculus for how many, you know, for a given episode, how much actual time did it take to put it out?
Yeah, about 6-7 hours is a reasonable estimate. And that's everything from like finding the guest and, you know, coordinating some schedule and then recording the show for an hour, hour and a half, and then doing the editing part, the show notes, putting it all together and then shipping it out.
Yeah, so I think that's the thing, is that it's just all the rest of it, right? It's like the conversation is the fun part, but it's probably a little less for me just because I have Carlton's that helps, you know, with chatting and stuff, but it's still probably a good 5 hours per episode total. And like, you know, out of 40 hours in a week, you know, ostensibly it's a chunk. I mean, it's basically a day.
Mm-hmm.
Like, basically, you know, we're recording on a Tuesday. I basically take today to just do all the stuff and try to set up guests. And so, you know, it's 20% of my time when we do it, but we don't do it all the time. Yeah. Well, Carlton, do you have questions? I mean, what were some of the, I don't know, highlights that from the guests, because I agree, like, it's for us having the podcast is it's amazing. We get, like, we're speaking to amazing guests in all realms of, you know, walks of the tech world. And it kind of keeps my excitement up instead of just, you know, the computer and reading blog posts. It's like, oh, there's people and, like, they have passions and interests and they introduce me to things. It kind of keeps it fresh for me, at least. Did you find that to be the case for you, Nick?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I learned also.
Carlton, what about you? What are you, Carlton? You're tired of talking to guests?
No, I like having the guests. Like, you know, the bit you said, Nick, about getting to reach people from the different walks of life, you know, seeing different people in the different areas of the Django community, you know, people are using it in their work, people are working on the framework themselves, you know, everybody in between. I think that keeps it fresh and worth doing for us. But yeah, I couldn't. It's the summer holiday for us. It's the break at Christmas. It's the only doing it once every fortnight. That makes it sustainable, I think.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. That's something I didn't do, but I've noticed other podcasts, not companies, but like your guy, like you do have like quote unquote seasons, right? There's like a period where you take X amount off.
Yeah, no. And
I think it's helpful that, I mean, maybe if we had advertisers, we'd feel different because it'd be more of a monetary pressure, you know, where, you know, if you have... do it once a week, then you're like, oh, I could go twice a week and make twice the money. And then there's the algorithms. But for us, it's just for fun. I mean, I think it's a little bit of marketing, but that's not the primary goal. So I think if anything, we've leaned into that the last couple of years, Carlton, right? I mean, we want to take time off, we take time off. Like, it just helps the burden, right? Because there is this burden when you're putting out content regularly and you feel like you need to. And I think that's sort of like the burnout cycle. Same thing with work, right? Like, just relentless inbound. And you never get a moment to feel like you're in control, even if the inbound doesn't stop.
And I guess I just follow up with that one, is that you've got a schedule, you've got a month, you plan your week, and you've got all these things on your job list. And when there's something which like takes up, oh, that's 10, 20% of the time gone. Ah. And then, you know, there's these other two or three things on the list, and all of a sudden it's like, oh, I'm actually under pressure. Whereas if you can just sort of pause one of those things, all of a sudden, there's so much more space in your life, and it's like, ah, I can breathe, I can, you know, I've got time. So being able to drop the podcast for the summer, that's just like, okay, yeah, and we'll join you again in the autumn.
And maybe, Nick, maybe you can give Carlton tips, because it's only been 4 or 5 days since he stepped down as a Django fellow, which he'd been doing for 5 years. So, you know, I guess you went and got a job, so there wasn't really, like, a lot of downtime, but... I don't know. There's probably some settling when you take something that you've been doing all the time, at least for me, just on the Django board, which is a smaller time commitment. I think it took a good 2-3 months to wrap things up that I needed to do, but also just to be like, I don't have to check that email every day. Like the brain kind of settles into, oh, that's not there. It's not just an immediate thing, like a vacation or something. Was that the case for you at all, Nick?
Yeah. And it's also funny enough, like, it's somehow almost works like the opposite too, where it's like, wait, I have all this free time now. And like, suddenly the more free time I have, the more unproductive I am. Like, have either of you guys noticed that as well? Because actually, yeah. Well,
yeah. But it's this is my take, and I want to hear Carlton's, but like, so what is productivity, right? I feel like there's a built up kind of stress pressure, and we feel like productive is when we're like grinding through podcasts or doing things we know how to do that take time and energy. But really, it's when you have a moment to be bored or a moment to reflect or a moment to sit around that you kind of actually are creative and actually are truly productive. And there's these blips. But at least for me, it feels uncomfortable to find the space because it's so hard to block off the space. But it's like, it's only when I'm like, you know, like yesterday I sent Carlton a picture, like, I got the Harry Potter video game. And, like, I have no time to play video games. I've got kids and stuff. But still, if I find half an hour, like, I'm convinced that's when I'm going to have, like, an insight. Because it's like my brain is focused somewhere else. Anyway, so I'm very kind with the idea that, like, I don't need to be constantly, like, going to be productive. It feels productive, but I feel like it's actually probably not productive in what I do anyways. Sorry, that's a long tangent. I want to hear what your thoughts are on it.
Yeah, Carlton, you want to chime in?
Okay, so I'm still...
And Carlton influenced me on this, right? He's the one who's like, kids are good because you're playing with the kids, you're thinking about something else, like it all counts.
Yeah, no, like you've got to distract the left brain, right? So the right brain can get on and do its thing. Otherwise, the left brain's just like, yeah, we're going to focus on words and things and logic and space. And the right brain's like, no, I want a bit more freedom to do. So put on some music, play with the kids, do something different. That's important. That's where the insight comes from. That's why it's in the shower. Your left brain's like, hey, I'm busy washing. The right brain's like, ha ha, here's your genius idea for the day. Like, that happens. For me personally, I'm still going through this kind of process of clearing the COVID backlog. We had that year of lockdown, and then we had illnesses, and then massive stress. And I got to the point last year where I literally had to put a pause on almost everything and just take on one thing at a time, get the next Django release out. Okay, that was out. Get the channels update out. Okay, do the conference, or, you know, just get through to the end of the year, and managed to do all of that. And then just as I was sort of reaching an even keel, my daughter had an accident. She was, you know, ill. That was pretty serious. And then my son's now ill, and it's like, okay, right, just take it one step at a time. And so for me, it's like, okay, finishing the fellow role, got to the end of March, got, you know, said I was going to stop at New Year, 3 months to wind up and, you know, give time for finding a new fellow and all those sorts of things. Okay, fine. Now breathe. What's next on the list? Well, for me, it's Button, which is my simple deployment story for Django that's been on the back burner for 2 years, and I just really haven't had any chance to work on it. Well, okay, that's what I'm going to work on now. And for me, it's like productivity 101. If you've got too much on your plate, too many balls in the air, put them down, get one ball, get rid of that. Then that's one ball less. Get the next ball, process that, get rid of that, one ball less. Then all of a sudden, it's like, oh, do you know what? Actually, I've got an empty job list. And I know that's really basic, but when you're stressed, when it gets too much, you've got to take those kind of emergency steps to just focus on what's important. That's my tech. That's how I've got through the last 2 years, and that's how I plan to continue.
Yeah, that's very insightful. And was there a special like moment in your brain when you knew like I had to make the change to reduce the list?
Yeah, it was the start of. So what is it now? It's 2023 now. So start of 2022, I was just going for a walk, and I had a phone call from the neighbors of my parents, and my mother had been taken ill and was in hospital. And it was like, just one too many things. And at that point, I was like, I got to take remedial measures now. My life's on fire. So, okay, how do we stop this? Well, okay, we pause, we focus, put that to the side. You know, just, and it really is productivity 101. You read any productivity books, project management for dummies. It's like, well, take, if you've got too many projects, pick the one that's most valuable, do that first. And okay, fine. So at that point I had to deal with family, and then, you know, they had the big Django release I was release manager for, and then, you know, so on. And there was just a list that went on. And around October time, around DjangoCon US last year, I thought, yeah, I've cleared the COVID backlog. It's great. I'm, you know, on the head. And then my daughter had her accident. And then, you know, life said, no, you haven't. No, you haven't. So it carries on. And now it's like, okay, I finished fellowing, Button, and then the summer, and then, you know, we'll see what comes next.
Yeah. Yeah, the idea of just like identifying, maybe not so much burnout, but just knowing when you have too much on your plate.
Yeah,
yeah, I think that's a really important skill that I know you need the time to just introspect on yourself.
Yeah. And it's like, yeah, it wasn't necessarily burnout, but it was like, if this isn't now sustainable, it's burning the fuel too quickly. And you've got to, if you can identify that and take measures before burnout, then that's helpful, I think.
Yeah. And I also like what Will said before, just around like, you need that time just to let your mind wander. Like for me, I still do like walking or jogging time for me is non-optional, like at least an hour and a half a day and two times a day, maybe not like 3 hours total, but you know, like 45 minutes per time, super important. Like, and I don't know, like the shower thought thing is like the most realest thing ever. Like almost every programming problem I ever have, it's like either in the shower, on a walk, or like 8 seconds before I fall asleep, that's when it gets fixed.
Yeah. No, entirely. There's nothing, I'm banging away at the debugger and then I'm not making progress. I'm going to go and cook dinner. And then halfway through cooking dinner, it's like, oh yes, of course, colon.
It's also challenging when, I think for all of us, have done and do consulting too. So it's easy to think when you're feeling not bored, but you're like, oh, I'm not quite sure. It's like, oh, gee, I could be doing something that makes money. Like that sounds good. That feels good to be productive. So it's even harder when it's like, oh, well, like, instead of going for a walk for, you know, it's like that could be, you know, X amount of dollars and that would feel nice. I don't know why, but like that would, you know, it also takes a while to kind of get over that, to be like, yes, I do want to do consulting and it's valuable, but also, you know, not just fill the void with, paid things, which, you know, sometimes obviously you have to, but it sort of gets this feeling of, I think, enough, you know, enough in terms of work, in terms of money, and valuing that time of like not doing all these other things.
There's always some like mental visualization that I have in my mind. Like, have you ever been in a plane? I'm assuming you guys have been. And the flight attendant is always like, you know, if something goes crazy, you have to put your mask on before you can put the mask on of your children or family members or whoever might need it. Because without you being okay, like, they can't be okay. So like that analogy in my mind, I always think about that in terms of myself, like, you know, like trading time for money as doing consulting work or whatever. It's like, wait, you gotta step back and like make sure you're okay before you can do the other stuff.
Yeah, no, entirely. Absolutely, 100%. And that applies to everything in life, like parenting. Like, you know, if you're not emotionally well in yourself, you can't help your children to be emotionally balanced. It's, yeah.
Well, you can justify it. You can say now they're seeing that even parents get stressed and raise their voice. But yes, yeah. That's the exercise I go through. Well, you're seeing daddy's not perfect.
It's how you handle being not perfect.
You're welcome. Well. Yeah. Well, not that there's any worry about that, but but you know, it can lead a conversation of like, you know, I'm sorry I raised my voice at that time, but like, you know, parents have feelings too, and we get frustrated, and you get frustrated, and you know,
yeah,
da 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 da.
So, Engel, we should.
Carlton, you're headed off to Florence.
Oh, well, I was going to say we should cut back to Nick here, because so Nick, you were saying you were doing lots of work, the podcast, you dropped the podcast, then so how is it you came to seek full-time employment or seek a gig or seek a job to instead of that?
Yep. So that one was kind of interesting. So prior to the full-time gig, like even when I was doing the courses, podcasts, et cetera, you know, I was still spending a majority of my time doing contract work. Yeah. And there was a company where, I don't know, since the end of 2018, I was doing contract work for them. Like, I started off helping them get their apps running in Docker on AWS. And like, you know, I had consistent work with them, maybe sometimes 5 to 20 hours a week. And I just continuously did that with them. And eventually, you know, they were asking if I can join full time. And I said, no, thank you. And then they asked again. And I said, no, thank you. And then they asked again. And then like, you know, 9 months later, I decided to join them full time.
Okay. And so tell us about your role. You're still there.
You're doing, I think you said before, like focusing on deployments stuff, right?
Yeah. So I've been there now for about 18 months, a year and a half. And my role is kind of interesting. It's sort of kind of all over the place-ish, but it is focused on, yeah, just, I guess, deployments is the core critical component of it. So I'm dealing with Docker and Kubernetes and just AWS and Terraform, Ansible, a lot of shell scripting, basically developer tooling. So like trying to help build tools to make the developers more productive, just going over like CI/CD processes, or generally like dealing with releases, like how can we make that more efficient? Even if that spans beyond just like writing code, you know, it's just like, how do we take an idea from like concept to rolling it out to production?
Okay.
Yeah, it's kind of all over the place, but it's nice because I feel like I have basically almost full autonomy. So, you know, I still report to somebody. The person that I report to is the person I worked with directly when I was doing contract work. So it was a really nice fit there. But yeah, we just like bounce ideas off each other every week and just, you know, work on doing things that take priority. And I guess priority is an interesting word because, yeah, it's like there's so many good things to do. Like, how do you pick one?
Yeah. Okay. So the list of tools you ran through there was basically like everything in the sort of DevOps candy store, like, you know, Ansible, Terraform, AWS, Docker, Kubernetes. Like, what are your favorite bits of the stack? And, you know, what lights you up about all of that?
Man, that's a fun question. So for the longest time, I avoided Kubernetes for years. And I kind of hopped on board with the meme wagon where it's like, oh, it's so complex. Like, no one's ever, like, why would you ever use that thing? And the more that I use it now, the more that I actually like it. And just for context, like the place that I'm working at, we're not at like crazy mega, like insane scale where we're spinning up thousands of containers with like hundreds of developers. No, like the dev team, there's 11 developers. We've got 8 services. And it got to the point where Kubernetes started to make sense for us because we were spinning up individual EC2 instances or servers for each service. And there was a lot of duplication there. So we converged on one cluster. And now, I don't know, I'm liking Kubernetes actually a lot, especially with another tool called Argo CD. I don't know if you've heard about this one. But yeah, it follows this philosophy of like GitOps, where right now, like instead of pushing code to the cluster with maybe doing, I don't know, some... Well, first of all, before we get into great details, have either of you worked with Kubernetes a bit or no?
I've worked locally, but I haven't used it as like a tool in production because I haven't been in the position of deploying the multiple services where you need all those. And that's the bit for me where I'm like, I don't want to deploy it for my... I don't want to use the extra complicated tooling for one service or one service in a worker. You know, it just doesn't make any sense.
Right. So like the 30-second... Okay. The 30-second elevator pitch on Argo CD is like, you know, you can kind of have your Kubernetes config files in a Git repo somewhere, and like it will just check your Git repo on a specific branch every 3 minutes, and it will just converge the state of what's in that Git repo to the actual cluster. So like I don't need to like push deployments. It's more like pull-based. So we just modify the config files to be like, hey, here's the new Docker, you know, tag version for the image. It picks it up. It rolls it out. You know, it handles basically the, you know, CD part, like continuous deployment.
Yeah. And it's kind of like declarative rather than imperative.
Yeah, exactly.
I feel like I'll just sit back for the next 40 minutes because, I mean, Carlton has been doing with Button, you know, DevOps stuff, and it's not really my wheelhouse. But
I mean, okay. So You just used the magic word there, Will. You said DevOps. So, I mean, is DevOps a thing or a practice or what? What's your view on... I mean, would you describe yourself as doing DevOps, Nick? Is that your...
I don't know. Like, I don't even know what my official title is, but it doesn't have DevOps in it.
Right,
but, like,
okay.
I feel like, to me, like, just informally, to me, DevOps is... It's more of a mindset. It's like an orchestration of things. It's not necessarily, like, what you do. You know, it's not, like... It's not comparable to Kubernetes or something. It's more just like a workflow of things that you do to make everything better and not necessarily just like the tech part, right? Like it's not a CI/CD system. It's like, well, how do we have this idea, right, that can go from development to production in the most efficient way possible, balancing with developers and like product teams and everything.
And when I started, there was like this uncrossable divide between the developers and then the sysadmins, and you'd kind of sort of as a developer you'd get your app ready to go, and then you'd sort of have to throw it across the divide to the sysadmins on the other side, and they weren't really that interested in catching it. And if it fell into the chasm, well, oh well, not a problem. Or if they dropped it and it smashed, oh well, not a problem.
They're just stroking their neck beards. Yeah, no, and it's guilfoyle and
it was
Silicon Valley.
Kind of like that. And the thing I sort of like about the DevOps approach or the philosophy or whatever is, I think, is that it's supposed to bring the developers closer to actually being able to get their code across that divide, if that divide still exists.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, fully agreed. So like specifics about our dev team setup, you know, we've got 10 or so devs, a couple different teams, like let's say 3 devs on each team. And they can take their whole idea from concept to production on their own.
Yeah.
Now, I help set up like a CI/CD pipeline for them so they can deploy things. But from their perspective, all they need to do is, you know, make the pull request like they normally do. It gets peer reviewed by someone on their team. And then the quote unquote release manager is really just, you know, the engineering manager has to say okay to have the release. But him is just like literally merging that pull request is the release. And that's it. Like as soon as that happens, things get kicked off and get auto deployed. So they don't need to worry about like, what is Kubernetes or Argo CD or any of these other tools. And then it's on them to, just make sure it's running well. So like I've set up Datadog stuff like logging and metrics, and they can see the insights on their app. Like I help them, you know, debug and profile things, but, you know, they've got all the tools they need without necessarily needing to be, you know, crazy deep in the woods with the gory details.
Okay, that's good. So can I ask so that's quite a big team. And I think that's, you know, as you describe, it's a lovely setup. You've got something where the developers are freed to just sort of push to their code and it's all ready to go, almost like a platform as a service. But for a smaller team, like at what point, so I very much for like a small, you know, 1 to 5 where you haven't really got the specialist ops operation, keep it simple, you know, spin up the single EC2, run it on there, scale that up for a bit. I kind of think that small scale works much better. But what point do you think you grow out of that, or that it makes more sense to move to? Something like the setup you've described.
Yeah, I think it really depends. There's like multiple different components that you can scale off of when you need to do that. Like, for example, number of developers on your team versus also like number of services you might have. There's still technically, I guess, value in Kubernetes a little bit, like even if you had one big monolith or something, just because, you know, it abstracts away some of the details that are hard to do yourself, like just doing rolling updates, like a zero downtime deploy, like keep this one version running, put up the new one, and then get rid of the old one in the load balancer, that type of stuff. I'm curious, Carlton, did you end up rolling some of that stuff basically on your own?
Yeah, well, just using systemd is the bottom line with a socket agent, and then you just a socket unit, and just so that the daemon runs the socket unit, which loads the service, and then you just get the next the socket unit pointing to a different service file, and then reload the daemon, and it will refresh the put to point to the new service without loss of connection, because it keeps the socket open. It works very well for, you know, again, a small deploy. How big do you want to push that? You know, you're running multiple services on a single instance? No, because they get in the way of each other, and you just don't want to do that. And it's what's interesting for me is the point at which you grow out of that. You know, that's the bit where I'm, you know, that's not really where I'm targeting with Button. I'm targeting very much the simple setup. You know, you've got an app, you want to get it online. What's the story that saves me having to take a week of learning, you know, tools which are perhaps too powerful? But I also want to have a story for, okay, at this point you need to start considering, you know, EKS or whatever the other options are that are a bit more powerful.
Yeah, no, I really like that approach. And honestly, for my own stuff too, like if I were to, you know, put together my own software as a service, you know, like some like real thing that customers would be paying for, yeah. I'm going to be deploying that to one server, probably using Docker Compose, maybe using Carlton service, depending on if, you know, when it's available.
But yeah, yeah. No, I mean, go on, carry on.
No, but that was it. Basically, I'm a big fan of using what works right now, reacting to that later if I need to, and then like transitioning to that when I have to, because there's a very good chance maybe I don't have to, because I'm sure as you discovered, right, like you can really put together a serious app, you know, hundreds of thousands of monthly visitors on a $40 a month DigitalOcean server, and guess what? You're good to go.
Like, yeah. Yep. No, I mean, that was exactly what... So, I've been putting stuff on servers for 20 years since I was at university, and I've worked on some quite big things, and never have I worked on a thing which actually couldn't just scale, you know, one or two boxes with a little load balancer in front of, and you'd handling the traffic isn't the question. Like, what's the question, I think, is handling the dependencies between the various bits you're deploying. Or if, you know, if you've got an add-on which suddenly needs some old version of Python or some, you know, then that's low, use a container then, because what you don't want to do is try and manage these multiple versions of Python on the same box, and this one needs that version of this, and this one needs that, and dependency hell and all those things.
Yeah. And if you do need some like special use case where, you know, everything works fine on one server, but maybe you have some really heavy like Celery background workers running, there's no harm in just putting that Celery process on its own server.
Yeah,
you know, like
somewhere
just a second
else.
Server.
Yeah, yeah,
like no. It's just going to pull things off a Redis queue and that's it.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And, you know, and the motive, what got me started in all this, you know, and what I'm, you know, bringing to completion now was the frustration of seeing, beginners, you know, perhaps they use Will's book, you know, got their first app online, and then getting sucked into a kind of pro level ops game, which was totally inappropriate for them. And that's what I'm trying to avoid. But what are you building? What are you deploying? So you're deploying these 8 services. Are you building with Django and Python or a different stack?
So there are 2 Python services that are using Flask. Sorry, in advance, by the way, because
that's okay.
It's compatriots, not competitors.
There we go. Yes, we're all like on the same team. But yeah, the other ones are more just really large PHP applications that I am not so much involved with in the day to day, but they are being deployed.
Are they using Laravel or Symfony or?
They are using CodeIgniter.
Okay.
So. Because it's been around for a long time. You know, we're talking like 12 years of development on the apps.
Okay, fantastic.
Not fantastic.
No, no, but... Ah, well, there's my view. See, people apologize for code. I've got this view that any running software is just amazing. It's like a miracle of, you know, a miracle of life. And something that's been in production for 12 years, that's, you know, that's a massive achievement. And it's never going to be the case that it's going to be using all the latest this or the latest that. It's never going to be perfectly clear. clean code. It's never going to be, there's going to be horrible bits about it, but you kept it going for 12 years and you built, you know, code with it. That's an achievement. I think, you know, not you, but the team and the company. I think that's a, I think, you know, I just don't think we should apologize for old code.
Yeah. And I think that's an awesome takeaway too, right? Because it's like your customers don't necessarily care that much about your tech stack as long as you provide a valuable service to them that they like using and it runs reasonably fast and like user experience is good, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah, it all works in the end.
Okay.
So Nick, I have a question for you. So you're a teacher. How do you explain this? I'm thinking of this because I have the 4.2 update to my books about to come out, hopefully by the time this podcast comes out. And I've been adding a lot more of the how, not just the why. That was one of the early criticisms of my books. But I sort of showed how to do things, but I didn't dive into the weeds because I didn't want to overwhelm people. And I've added a lot more in subsequent editions and visualizations. But there's this big jump from local to production, right? And how do you, like, it's hard to explain to someone who's learning code. Like, yeah, all three of us could build Twitter in a weekend, but we couldn't build it at scale. Like, so like, why is it so hard? Like, so how do you explain to people like the difference between like 1,000 users and like 1,000,000, right? Because that's where you get into load balancers and servers and DevOps. But it's hard for people to feel that, and because they can't just, you know, like we can just build a clone of something and feel it, but you can't mimic the scale and size. And even if you could, it's expensive. So you kind of have to be thrown into the fire. I'm curious how you approach that question, because I constantly think of how to explain it in real terms, not just abstractly being like, yeah, like there's two real engineers and there's like 10 DevOps for anything at scale and they do a lot of stuff and it's complicated and you don't want to deal with that. Use a platform as a service. Like that's kind of my glib answer to beginners. Anyways, so what do you say when someone asks you that as an expert teacher?
Yeah, that's a good question for sure. And, you know, I think Heroku kind of did an okay job at this one. How long ago? Like, do you remember this 12-factor application? Like, it's a methodology they put together. And what I found, at least, like even doing some contract work and everything, is that oftentimes the scaling part, it's not so much the details of the scaling. I mean, that is a hard thing to cover for sure. But it's just, yeah, just getting your application ready to scale is a whole completely separate topic. And it's like a precursor to being able to scale. Like, for example, you know, let's say that you have some user authentication and your session backend is just running in memory, right? Not using Redis or anything like that. And now it's like, well, now you have to go to two servers, but now you've got two copies of your application running. User hits server A, they're logged in. User hits server B, they're not logged in because it's in process memory. That's a problem. Other problems are like file uploads, right? You upload your avatar, but it only goes to one server, not the other. Suddenly someone gets on server B and avatar's not there anymore. So it's like you've got all these dependencies that you need to like handle or precursors to scaling out.
Yeah.
So I think it starts there, in my opinion.
I'd agree with that. When one of the first gigs I ever had, there was, you know, this line was from somebody there was like, the hardest thing you do is move to two servers, like from one to two servers. That's the hardest jump. And then, you know, three, well, you've already done everything you need to do to get to two. So three is not too bad.
Yeah. So the takeaway there is like, figure out what you can do to stay with one. So you never have to do the hard stuff. But
right. Yeah. I mean, I think it's, so yeah, I think many of the stack for me, the apps you're working with is PHP. I don't know if you use, is it Laraforge or whatever the hosting thing is there, but you know, that's a multi-million dollar business. And he's written publicly, I think it's on two, three, like servers, the entire thing for like hosting thousands, however many PHP apps, you know, he just like, it's a good example of like, you don't need to, if you don't need to do all this stuff, don't do it and try really hard not to do it. Like seems to be maybe the takeaway for listeners.
Yeah. And for
right? I mean, except, yeah, it's a bit like third party, you know, on a local level for someone who's newer, I think it's a little bit like third party packages in that when you're starting out, it's like, oh, great. It's like superpower. Just toss them all in and they all do stuff. And I don't know why, but boom, there's my authentication. There's this and that. But then it's the update hell and you don't really understand it. And it does come back to bite you to the point where like now I don't use third party packages unless I really, really, really need to. And I kind of know they're really, really good because I'm just like, it's like a parachute, every additional thing, right? Because the updates is always, it's always the packages. But actually that leads into a thing you mentioned before you came on air, you just updated to Django 4.2, even though it came out yesterday? Yeah, yesterday, Carlton.
Yeah.
Can you, how is that update process? And then Carlton can tell us about all the blood, sweat, and tears to get that release out. I know Marius was a release manager, but
I'm going to have to say, before Nick answers about updating his package, I'm going to say there was no blood, sweat, and tears at all because I wasn't doing it. Marish,
well, 4-1 then. 4-1 then. You're walking on bodies.
Marish was doing it all by himself, and poor fella. But he managed to get it out the door all totally smoothly. So well done, him. Go on, Nick. Tell us about your starter project.
Right. So I do have a Django starter project that is using Docker Compose. Like, it is optimized for that one server deployment type of thing, but also good for dev. And yeah, so I updated to Django 4.2, like, I don't know, an hour before this podcast call now. And that was a very, very, very painless update. So one thing that I do is when I jump between Django versions like 4.1 to 4.2, like minor versions or a major one, what I like to do, since I'm, you know, I have a starter project, I like to generate a new project using 4.1, generate a new project using 4.2, and then I'll do a directory diff on that to see what changed, like the project generators for creating a new project or apps or whatever. And in that case, there was like basically no changes at all. I mean, a lot of it was just updating the 4.1 link to 4.2, like, you know, Django in the settings file. Yeah. They give you good links to, like, here's how to, you know, do database configuration. So it was that. And there was like one string and one doc string that changed, but it was super painless. I also updated PsychoPG2 to using, what is it now? PsychoPG. There's not like a 3, you know, but yeah, it does install version 3.
It is version 3. It's the new. So that's, yeah, we can talk about that if you like. There's so it's the new back end. It's a new version of PsychoPG, and it's got asynchronous drivers, and it's quite exciting. So it's going to be the future. And there are a few little niggles, like if you know, things with tuples and whatnot that you need to watch out for, a couple of gotchas on whether it's strictly backward incompatible. But it's, you know, if you just install the new package, Django will just use it. And for most use cases, it, you know, it's totally transparent. But what I think it, for me, the exciting thing at least, is that it gives us the opportunity to have the asynchronous client. So 4.2, we've introduced support for streaming, async streaming responses. So you can return a streaming response with an async generator. And if you're running under ASGI, it will stream it out asynchronously without blocking your worker, without blocking a thread like it would under WSGI. And you can generate, you know, it's good for service end events or long polling or these kind of long live request examples. And so with an asynchronous Postgres connection or Postgres client, we could in principle use listen notify to, you know, do an update, have something trigger in the database, which then notifies the client, you know, some kind of real-time goodness. And it's, you know, over the next, you know, year, 2 years or so, those patterns will become codified and blogged about, and, you know, maybe there'll be third-party packages wrapping up exactly the best patterns for doing that. But that's an exciting and fertile terrain that we're in now. That's, it's like, okay, these are new usage patterns for Django that haven't been available before. And, you know, you could have done similar in channels or whatever, but to have the asynchronous database driver there as well, it's like the full stack. It's like, okay, there's some opportunities here for things which weren't previously possible. So that's what I'm excited about.
Yeah, I like that you use the term like the full stack there, because I guess to get the full advantage of async, you do need your database layer to have it and your view layer to have it. And, you know, these things need to work together if you want the full experience. And I think there is like an async test client as well, right?
Yeah.
For Django?
Yeah, yeah. So you can, I mean, the test, so there's two bits. The sync client will test async views. So you can have an async def view and it'll, you know, you can make an HTTP request to it with the sync client, and it will test, it will run your async code and return it. And so you don't need to necessarily write a sync test case. But say, for instance, you're writing a middleware, an async middleware, and you want to test its async behavior sort of outside the full Django stack, the full request response cycle. Well, then you would use the async client, because you could write an async def test. And you can get you can do all these kind of things. You don't necessarily need to use the async test client for your kind of standard view test. You know, did this view return this response? It can be an async def view, but you can still use the sync client for perhaps simpler testing. So
okay. So just to rewind back to what it was like, to update to 4.2, super easy on my end. Like the starter project, it's not like building out a lot of business logic. So there, I didn't have to go back and modify a whole bunch of different queries just because it's all set up and ready to go. Like you're, you know, as the application developer would be using the starter project to build your own app. But Carl Turner, Will, I'm curious, like what was it? Have either of you updated like an actual application to 4.2 yet? And like, what was that experience like?
I have to admit, I haven't. It's only been out since yesterday. But I'm on 4.1 point, whatever the latest is, and it will be totally seamless. I think the biggest thing is the storages change. So storages have become a dictionary now so you can define multiple storages. And the old settings have been deprecated for the new one. But Adam Johnson has his Django upgrade project, which has got an updater for that, which you can use. So there's two or three small settings updates like that, which I'll be running Django update to use. I'm quite excited about Django update. I think it'd be really nice if every single release we can ship a set of, you know, to run this updater and it will automatically go through your code and make the necessary changes so that, you know, you don't have to worry about those.
Nice. Does that, I haven't used that updater yet or upgrader yet. Does that run something like Black where it will like go through everything and kind of look at things and either warn it or you know, warn you or do it?
Yeah, it's based on like the same idea as Py upgrade. So Py upgrade, you run it, say, Py upgrade to, you know, 3.10 syntax, and it will go through and look for all the cases where, you know, the new syntax is this and you should be using that, or, you know, this import moved. It's done with the AST module. So like, you know, how Black constructs your AST and then rewrites the code exactly how it's meant to be. Well, Django upgrade does the same thing, but looking for, you know, have you defined this setting? Okay, though this setting should be rewritten like this in this case. It's a really interesting project because one thing we want to do for, say, Django 5.0 is modernize the request object. We want to add a request.data property, which would handle, for instance, JSON content. You know how you get form data passed in request.post? Well, you know, if you've got JSON, instead of having to manually pass the body, you could get that pass automatically and then give that pluggable passes maybe. But while we're at it, there's a proposal to modernize the request. So instead of request.get, have with capital letters screaming from, you know, and it was basically copied from PHP back in the old days, to have request.query params, which is a more, you know, Pythonic style, lowercase, snake case, you know, a bit more modern. And the worry with doing that has always been that we've got so many deployments that people are like, please don't break our code, please don't break our code. But if we can have a project like Django Update that's scriptable to automatically rewrite your code, it makes that transition less jarring for people. And then it makes it more realistic that we can do big upgrades, you know, big changes that have previously perhaps been a bit like, we can't do that because it will upset too many people, or, you know, it's not worth it.
Yep. Yeah, I love that idea. Will?
Can I ask, did you run deprecation warnings when you were on the new version, like add the flags on run server? Do you know about these?
So the starter project that I have, at least, it doesn't use the run server. It uses Gnucorn both in development and production. And I guess just to segue back to what Carlton was saying around, like, you know, what are some things you can do to prepare your app to scale or whatever. I guess this is not necessarily related to scaling, but I do like to keep my development setup as close as possible to production within reason. Like I would always use Postgres. If I'm using Postgres in prod, I'd use it in dev, etc. But likewise with Gnucorn, I do the same. And oh man, I remember it was at Django 4.1. I think it was. There was some change to how it deals with the template loaders. So when I was using Gnucorn in development, like the default loader no longer does, like, I don't know, enables caching by default. So like I was updating my HTML templates and it didn't reload my templates in development. And I was like, what the heck is going on? And then someone replied to a Twitter question I had within honestly like 15 minutes of me asking the question. And they're like, yeah, you need to explicitly, you know, not use the cached loader in development. But that was super easy to fix. Like, yeah, another like random question thing, like just knowing the problem sometimes is super helpful.
Okay, so there's a good question, Nick. So you'd like the 12, you mentioned the 12 factor, 12 factor idea where you move.
Methodology.
Yeah, methodology, thank you. Where you move configuration values into the environment variables is basically the one of the key approaches. But something like
a template config, which is quite an elaborate dictionary. How would you handle that? Would you handle that? Because I'd handle that with separate setting files. I'm happy to move things like secret keys out of setting files so I don't commit them to Git. But I still have, here's my dev settings, here's my production settings, here's my thing. Because, for instance, if I've got a templates config, that's a whole dictionary, or a databases config, that's a whole dictionary. I don't want to be mapping those from environment variables. I find that quite tricky. I'm wondering how you'd handle that exact case of needing to change the caching behavior for the templates config in development versus.
Okay. Doing this from memory because it was like months ago.
Yeah, sure.
So in the settings file for Django, there is a templates dictionary, or maybe it's an array of dictionaries, and it's got things like where you configure the backend, directories, options, things like that. And what I ended up doing there was I defined a new variable called default loaders, and this included, what did it include? The file system loader, app directories loader, and then I made another variable called cached loaders, and that one would take the default loaders and also append to that list the cached loader. And then inside that dictionary, the templates dictionary, you've got this loaders property. And there I just dropped in a one-line if condition, right, that said, okay, if debug, use the default loaders, else use the cached loaders. So there was no new environment variables that had to even be created. But if debug is enabled, then you get the good experience in dev. And if not, then you get the cached one in prod or any non-development environment.
Right. So you have you still keep a single settings file, but you've got this kind of multiple, you've got the various options defined in the one file and you branch.
Right. Which was just two separate like local variables, default loaders and cached loaders, and that was it. And then it was like a one-liner if condition in the actual templates dictionary or list, whatever.
No, good. That's all good. That's exactly makes.
So that's a lot of details to like narrate over audio, but like if you drop it into the show notes, I have a link to the commit that did that.
Oh, good. Yeah, we'll do that.
On your starter project?
Yeah, yep.
Okay, all right. I'll put that in there. I'll find it, yeah. Well labeled. It's not going to be like update. No, everyone's going to be looking at your commits. So I find that if you're just, I guess, using run server with the flags, I feel like most people have no idea that the deprecation flags are there. And there's all this work that people put in. So, for example, like with forms, there's changes. And in 5.0, they're going to be made permanent. And you would see that if you ran with the flags, but you otherwise wouldn't. And, it's a bit of like, okay, it's in the release notes. People talk about it. But, in the real world, people like don't know, right? Like until someone tells you. So I guess, did you see anything on forms? Are you aware? I mean, you don't need to be because it's a 5.0 thing. But like there's some changes to how forms are processed in Django coming. I'm just wondering if, so doing the upgrade process, you probably wouldn't see it unless you'd like deeply read the release notes and decide to act on it and had run it with flags. But as someone who uses Django, but like is a jobbing developer, lots of other things, like it probably didn't come up for you, right? Because it's not going to break things yet.
Right. Yeah. I'll be completely honest. I didn't even know Django 5 has been started to be created, but like generally speaking, yeah, that type of thing. I don't think I would have caught that one. I mean, I go through the change logs specifically, like the release notes, and look at everything. And I know that you guys do a great job updating those things, but I wonder, let me ask this. Has there ever been a case where you release a new version of Django, like a big minor or major update, and something didn't make its way into the release notes and like someone found it out after the fact and had to open up like a PR?
Yeah. I mean, that happens quite regularly. Is that not major things, but like, there'll be like a consequence of a change which is kind of backwardly incompatible in a weird way. And it's like, okay, actually, we're not going to revert the change. I mean, occasionally it's been like, no, actually, this is something that we actually have to revert. And that's more happens in the pre-release phase. And this is why we have the long pre-release phases, for people to test the pre-release versions. I can't remember the particular example off the top of my head, but I remember one a few releases ago, which it was quite a moderate change. And it went through and it was like, no, actually, at the release candidate phase, we have to revert this because it's too disruptive to the ecosystem. And, so we roll that back. But quite often they'll be like, look, let's add a release note clarifying exactly, if you're in this circumstance, what the change in behavior is, or, that happens quite a lot. Fortunately, we have an active community who do help during the pre-release phase. And, it's 3 months, I think, in order to catch bugs, catch regressions, you know, catch visual to things in the admin. Whenever we make a change in the admin, there's always visual regressions because, you know, CSS being what it is, and we're not, you know, we're not front end developers by sort of calling. But, you know, they'll get spotted, they'll get fixed, and there are, you know, normally we'll be able to do something. I mean, there's a good example came up this release cycle of module loading. So the cached manifest storage, which takes your JS files and your CSS files, and it creates a manifest of them, and gives you a long hash a file name so that you can put far future expires headers on, and when you update them, the hash changes and you don't have to clear your caches, and people get the latest JavaScript or latest CSS, but they get it from their browser cache where possible. Turns out there was a fix to make this work with module imports, you know, the latest JavaScript syntax, but it only captured some cases and there were some weird regressions. And we spent quite a lot of time during the pre-release phase trying to get that as good as we can. And in the end, there's a warning in the notes saying, look, this may not work for all cases and you may have to manually get rid of import statements in comments. Like they're commented, they're not real, but they've got the same syntax as import statements. And these come up in source maps and things like that. But to work through all of that and get that working properly was, you know, and what's the best option? Are we going to have to revert this? Well, this is, you know, it's a good feature. We want it. Ah, there's quite a lot of work that goes into getting it just so.
Yeah. I think there's a cool takeaway from that too, is just that, what is that one quote from a famous like computer science book or something? Like, with enough eyes or with enough eyeballs, all bugs are shallow. So it's like, yeah, no matter how much like predetermining you think you can do to prepare something, as soon as it goes out there in the wild, someone's going to find something.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And so like quite often we'll be there. Well, we're looking at PR. It's, you know, we think it's okay. We just sort of have to merge it because we either have to merge it or not merge it. And it's like, okay, let's merge it. And we know that we've got the testing coming up and people will find the problems.
Hmm. But Will, earlier you mentioned about those deprecation warnings with the run server. I feel like I'm missing out a lot. Like if I'm using Junicorn in development, is there any way that I can get like a Junicorn hook to get that?
No, it's not Junicorn, it's Python. So you run Python with the capital W flag, which is for warnings,
yeah.
And then you run it with all warnings. And then you get deprecation warnings, which are noisy by default, but also pending deprecation warnings. So the ones that will be removed two out, you'll get those show up in your console or in your logs, and then you can fix it.
Okay. Well,
I should do a blog post on this because I was using Django for years before I even knew about these and I feel like nobody knows about them, but there's all this work that's being done to say, you know, we're going to remove something. It's two versions out. And, you know, in some ways it's like the first place you should look if you're updating and just, okay, everything works. I'm going to move on with my life. I should, yeah, that'd be good. I'll do that. I'll do a little post because, you know, Adam's tool, Django upgrade, like there's a couple things that people should know about if they don't, just to, when you update your code,
but I think
how to do it.
As well for a like...
Yeah. Sorry, thank you for saying that.
If you're looking for ways to contribute, I think it's a great way. So when the new version of Django comes out, run your package with, you know, Python warnings all, and see what errors you get from your third-party package. So there'll be one from, you know, Django compressor, or one from all, or the one from Django filter, or one from, you know, whatever package you're using, and you'll be like, oh, there's the with Django 4.1 this raises that, and that's an opportunity to contribute to those packages, because the maintainer will be grateful to take the PR fixing that warning because they know they're going to have to do it before the final release. And, you know, it's a good way of getting in and finding something that's concrete and probably quite small to work on.
Yeah, it's great advice. And also, is this one of those cases too, where like if you have really good test coverage in your app, like as soon as you run your test suite, what these warnings enabled, you should see them right then and there, right?
Yeah. And it is like, you know, you can set them to error. You can have warnings as error and then the test will fail. But, you know, even if you just have them outputted to, you know, standard out, as long as you're not outputting lots and lots of text so that they get lost, you see them very quickly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a great like dry run of just what you need to do before you actually do the update. And funny enough, like, you know, if DevOps stuff is on topic maybe for this call, like, you know, this happens a lot. Like if you're adding a firewall in front of your service, you know, example.com or something, you may want to enable your custom rules in count mode instead of actually blocking. So you can see in the logs, like, hey, did this rule work the way I wanted it to? And then you can like change it to block later, you know? So you kind of get the insight of what's going to happen before making a dangerous change.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Put your ACL rule to block this IP and it turns out you get no more traffic ever.
Right.
Well, so we'll put a link, but it turns out, you know, the Django upgrade version, which is buried in the docs, does have, boom, resolving deprecation warnings. But again, it's priorities, right? This is a, now that Carlton and I are on the sidelines with Django, we can both make some of these things happen that we talk about. Like, let's make the docs, you know, let's have someone come in with a clean slate and organize things, because they are a bit of a mess, because nobody's really done that over the years.
I mean, literally everything you need to know is in there. I mean, and it has got how to upgrade and how to run with warnings, but it takes a while to find all of that, right?
I did want to, since we're talking about deployment, give a shout out to this project, Django Simple Deploy, which you may not have seen, Nick, but Eric Mathis has been working on this. He gave a talk at DjangoCon on this. This is a really exciting, like in terms of, I think of like, what does Django need? Like, big picture. I mean, it needs, so async, which is happening, probably needs a way to bring serialization instead of using Django REST framework. At some point, some version of that needs to come into Django itself. And then a better upgrade story. To me, those are kind of the big three. And so Eric's been working a lot on this. He's the author of Python Crash Course. And it currently works with Heroku, Platformer, and Fly. But it's exciting. I hope it gets legs in terms of being an option that's a platform agnostic that kind of tees up a standard vanilla application and makes it deployment worthy. So that's just something to mention regularly to people. That's kind of a cool project. I hope he continues with it and gets some help, but it's kind of exciting.
There's two things about Simple Deploy that I think one is it should be used for the Django Girls tutorial, I think, because it gives, like, they've been using the Python Anywhere setup, which is great, but it's kind of very Python Anywhere specific. Whereas if they had Simple Deploy, then it would could be, you know, actually we're going to use Fly today, or we're going to use platform.shell today, or we're going to use, you know, another back end for it. But it does this thing that Nick talks about, where you've got your project, then you can run Simple Deploy, and then you've got a diff to your project that you can look at and see, oh, these are the changes it had to make to deploy for Fly or deploy to platform.shell or whatever. So I think it's super. I'm really excited by that project.
Yeah. Were you going to say something, Nick?
No, it's okay. I was going to say I have not heard about that project yet, but I am going to check it out after this chat.
Yeah, and his talk did a good job from the most recent DjangoCon US. It's sort of strange times with platforms as a service. And again, the reason why my books have been delayed and being updated is moving off of Heroku, because they've had various problems. But it kind of makes me really appreciate what Heroku has done. And it still does. It's still there. You know, it's paid. But Heroku is pretty stable, if, you know, maybe neglected in a couple areas. But like, it's kind of amazing all the stuff they've done and still do. And then you see there's real growing pains with all these next generation platforms as a service. So, you know, specifically Fly, like I wrote the Django docs for them. I'm using them in my book. They're updating twice a week their command line tool. And there's all these little subtle things that keep changing. They're having, you know, all these platforms are having growing pains. So they're not quite Heroku. I mean, they haven't been like killing your database and like being completely off. But I kind of wish I could fast forward to 2 years from now where, you know, one or two have won out and they've figured out a lot of these, you know, Django specific issues that they're all kind of having, because there's all these cobwebs and stuff under the covers, you know, as they're finding. So it's a little, you know, as a book writer, it's a little frustrating because I have to update things all the time, but I think it's overall good. But it's like, oh man, Heroku, like, why couldn't you just stay Heroku? I don't want to write about deployment. I want to write about Django. Like, now I have to. Yeah, right? Why change?
Well, okay, but
I think I even said something to Carlton about this, and he was like, you're turning into a conservative. And I was like, there you go. There you go.
But why not use Simple Deploy in the book, Will, and then punt the question to that?
I might well for future updates. Yeah. I just have been focused on doing it raw, per se, but I'd love to put it to something else. I mean, the thing with the book is, I've constantly removed third-party packages over the years. Like, I've had stuff on Stripe, and I had a bunch of third-party packages, and now I'm really, really, really reticent to add any because I've just been caught by changes with them and then people saying, oh, this thing is broken. And, you know, it's like hard enough to make Django work, but it's all the other stuff. It's always the deployment and third-party package things that, you know, make the book not work. So like to the point where in the book, what am I using now? For the beginner's book, I'm only using Django AllAuth, Crispy Forms. There's like one or two other ones, but I'm like really pulled back on what I use just because I don't, the dependencies. Dependencies are what get you.
Yeah. So what do you do on the front end stuff like Bootstrap or Tailwind, or do you use ES Build or Webpack or nothing?
Yeah. So I'm still on Bootstrap just because I would use Tailwind. I will use Tailwind. That's all. But it looks fine, you know. I mean, and I do. I have to go through Bootstrap every time because every year or so there's a new thing and something breaks. But I'm still using Bootstrap. I mean, ultimately, it's not a book on layout. But yeah, I would use Tailwind and the Professionals book too. That's the one that's sort of tricky for me because that's the one I feel like I would optimize it and do kind of all these things. But I have to kind of take it to a point where it's maintainable and kind of universal rather than getting into the specifics of fully, you know, I have stuff on caching. I don't think I cover template caching just because it would be a 1,000-page book and I already can barely update them. But I don't know, maybe I can have specific courses on these things because I do think there's a need for it. It's just very hard to stay up to date on all of it.
I mean,
even for me,
just on updating, my other question was, people, do you think it would make sense to make the Professionals book, say 5.x, because I understand for the beginner's book, you want it to be, you know, the version because it matters what's in the shell and that things have changed slightly,
yeah.
But the professional stuff is at a slightly higher level and Django doesn't change very quickly. What do you think?
Yeah, I'm going to have to, so I don't go nuts. The problem, and Nick, you can relate to this. The problem is that I pin all the versions. Everything works. Like, it works. I test it. But then people just, you know, install the latest version of Django and say, hey, all these things are broken. Like I don't, you know, they're just going to do what they're going to do, even though I have a whole thing on how you do it. And I don't blame them for it, you know, like, fine. So I'm going to need to try to do something like that with the other two books because they're a lot harder to maintain. And yeah, I've still resisted doing the .x thing on it, even though in practice, like I missed the 4.1 update. So yeah, there's a maintenance thing. I think probably the biggest thing is, you know, shake my head. I think the biggest thing is maybe not making the Professionals book one big project, because I've used this analogy. It's just like a Jenga puzzle and just one thing breaks and I have to redo everything and it's hard to maintain. I would rather have it be concise areas, a little bit more like two scoops of Django, except that's very abstract. They don't actually show you how to code things. So, but like, you know, kind of like here's caching and let me go into all the things. Like that would make it a little more maintainable for me. I don't know, Nick, you've had this problem too, right? Because you have video too. You have full courses and video. Like the maintenance thing is tricky to figure out.
Yeah, I like how you used the word "had" as if I don't still have this problem. Like I still have this problem.
How do you keep?
But yeah, like you, I do pin everything to their exact like patch release, and then yeah, at the end of the course, I have incremental updates to be like, oh, we're gonna update from this to that. Here's how you would do it. But then it gets to the point where like you have so many updates at the end where it's like you just got to re-record everything from scratch because so much has changed over the last like 2 years or 3 years or whatever it happens to be. But I do like what Carlton mentioned too, like, you know, just having like the X variant, like instead of maybe doing those incremental updates live in the book, like literally a chapter for each individual one, maybe you can like bring it up to more of a higher level to be like, you know, here's what I would do when it comes to updating to a new version of Django. Like here's a checklist of stuff that I would tackle where you're not going into every specific step, but like you more generalize it.
That would probably be a pretty good, conclusion it before the conclusion chapter on updating. Yeah, I'm a broken record on what I thought for 4.0.1s I would have this, and maybe for 5.0 I'll have this, but Django isn't the problem. Django is not what changes. It's deployment or third party things. But
oh yeah, for sure. Especially like when was it, like 2 years ago, whenever like the M1 Mac started to come out, there were a lot of packages that just didn't support that. And then it's like, I try to do the thing, it doesn't work. Like, what's wrong? Like, it's broken. You know, like these are the types of bug reports that you get when people take your courses or go through books.
Yeah. I mean, I need to check if it's still there. I have a couple places where I'm like, if you're on an Apple thing with the M1, then you need to do this. And if you're not, you need to use that. And again, it's just like everything. Again, Carlton's been a fellow for 5 years. So this is all just like ripples on the oceans of stuff he deals with, but it's just like these little things. It's like, ah,
dealt.
Like, I just want to focus on the big. Dealt with. Yeah, past tense.
I'm retired.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Well, so Nick, we're kind of at time. Recently we've been ending with, what would you like to see if you could wave a wand changed in Django? And I kind of gave you my top three, so I hope that doesn't prejudice you. But, you know, as someone who uses Django, but it's not your main thing, and has experience with other web frameworks, is there some gaping holes that, you know, other frameworks and languages do well that Django could improve?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And like, I do like your idea of just generally, I mean, this wasn't like your takeaway thing, but like just the idea of minimizing dependencies is kind of nice. But I guess like what that really means is like more batteries included potentially with Django. And I know it's already batteries included, but like there are, at least like I have worked with Rails before too. And, you know, I don't know a lot about Laravel, but like I sort of just briefly glimpsed what's going on in all these communities just for the sake of curiosity. And like, you know, they've got this like built-in functionality to deal with like notifications, you know, like do I want to send an email out or an SNS message or maybe over a WebSocket connection so the user can get a little, you know, red dot next to their bell or something like that. I feel like other opinionated frameworks have solutions for that one. I may be speaking dumbly here because maybe Django does have a solution for that. I just don't know. But is it more like third party or kind of just like not quite?
Yeah. I mean, mail. Django, like core.mail is, could we just remove that? And then there must, I'm sure there's a package out there that handles, I know there's packages.
Yeah,
third-party packages which just do it much better, and they plug into, you know, SendGrid and simple email service and all these ones that you really want to be using.
Oh my God, SendGrid. This is another dependency hell. Like, because I haven't been able to remove it from the books, even though I'd want to. Like, they're constantly changing everything, and then Twilio bought them, and they're changing their auth. You know, so I have a chapter on email, and like 3/4 of it is like navigating SendGrid.
I like your answer there, Nick, because I did a missive recently about why I'd like more batteries in Python. And the answer from the sort of the Python team is, oh, it's about maintenance. And as someone on the Django team, when you say more batteries, I'm like, oh, it's about maintenance. So it's like, it's kind of like, yeah,
touche.
I totally feel where you're coming from. But also it's like, well, what is maintainable? I think there are so many good packages out there. And what I think we're missing from the ecosystem still, even with like Django packages and the great work that Will and Jeff do with the Django newsletter, is some kind of map of the Django ecosystem, where it's still not easy to find the solution for what you want that's already out there and actually well-maintained and it's easy to use. There's no, you know, I don't know what the solution is here.
I'm like raising my hand, you know, metaphorically. So there is the awesome Django repo Jeff and I maintain that's trying to do this. So it's ostensibly a curated list. So it's, if you look for email, it'll show you. We don't say, you know, it's not ChatGPT. We don't say this is the one to use.
Yeah, right.
That'd be nice. But there is, you know, somewhere between Django packages, which Jeff maintains now, which is all the packages, the awesome Django repo is designed to be like, you know, we're very strict on what's in there. But of course, people don't want to have like, oh, here's the top three and like choose your own adventure. They want someone who's an expert to just say, use this one right now. It's hard to be curated and subjective. I mean, it's like, because you kind of put yourself up for flack, you know, instead of saying it depends, it would be nice. But I agree, like maybe like the common question that, I mean, I have a top 10 Django packages list that's just by downloads, which is imperfect from PyPI, which kind of gives you a sense. So it's like Django, Django REST framework, Django cores. It would be, yeah, maybe it's worth sticking your neck out a little bit on that. I mean, we had a guest, Carlton, I forget who it was, who made the point that, who also has experience in other frameworks, who made the point that Django has a lot of batteries, but less magic than Rails. Because I think I was saying something like, it'd be nice if we just had a solution for all these things with these other ones. And he's like, no, hold on. Like, Django has a lot built in under the covers. It just is explicit and it's not as magical because, of course, you know, oh, the email works until it doesn't work. You know, Django is down the slope a little bit where it's a little more challenging as a beginner. But then when you want to customize it, which you will, it's easier to do than I'll pick on Rails, you know. One that's a little more magical. But, you know, like the auth system and stuff has so much built into it. in Django, perhaps even more than other frameworks. But you know,
yeah, those are all great points.
Okay, well, we're over time, but when we have a great guest, that happens. Are there any? So you have your courses. Do you want to give a plug to your courses or any before we depart, Nick?
Sure. Well, I'll do one quick hot pick just on the topic of email with everything. Have either of you quickly heard about a service or tool called Mailcatcher? It's something you run locally on your dev box, and it sets up a local SMTP server, and you can configure your Django settings or whatever to just send mail to it. And you don't need to contact a third-party service. It's not meant for production, but it's great for just local testing. So if you wanted a quick thing to do, it's got a Docker image that you can run. I've been using it now for a couple of months. I like it.
Okay, super. I'm going to check that out.
Simplifies sending email and development and tests.
Huh. Yeah, it looks like it's been out for quite a while, too. So,
Yeah. It's one of those funny things, right? It's like, it's been around since like 1837, but like I just learned about it a few months ago.
That's how the awesome Django repo started. Like in the newsletter, I'm always like, we're never going to fill it with projects. And invariably, we find at least two or three valid, interesting projects to add every time. But it sort of leads to like the cruft of, you know, we sort of, maybe I should put a forum question, be like, what are the common questions that you have about what third-party package does what? And make like a top 10, 15 list and just say, here you go, like, check these out. Because I think there are some answers, right? Like with authentication, it's all auth. You know, there are some answers, and where it's not, there's like maybe two competing ones. Like there's not that many out there, I would say. I think the list is doable.
Yeah.
It's a great idea. Of course, it'll be out of date in a year or two, and people will be like, why is it out of date? And you'll be like,
no, but it wouldn't be.
You're welcome.
Like the packaging doesn't change that.
No, quickly. I know.
You know, the ones that have, Django's so mature now that those packages, there are new packages that come out all the time, but the sort of core ones that have been around for a decade, they're not going anywhere. They'll still be here in another decade.
Well, and I should plug, I have a Django forum post on asking people, what are your top 5-10 packages that you install, which I think was fantastic. There's a lot of responses. So maybe it's worthy of just, you know, linking, you know, just, this is the problem, Nick, right? Like you have the content, it's more or less up to date, but like you're still doing stuff and people's questions are the same, but your mental space has moved on. And you're like, do I just repeat myself all the time, like on the video and then on the podcast and then the book and then in person? And yes, you do, right? Because like, it's new to them. Just because it's a little rote to you, you know, you just got to, like, it's like a wind me up doll, right? It's like academics, Carlton, right? You in another life, like stand up before class and be like, I'm going to tell you it. And I'll tell you what I told you.
Yeah.
Or you can read my book. Or like, I don't care.
Or like, you know, musicians, the Rolling Stones, they go to a gig, they play the same tracks.
Yeah.
50 years running.
They make a little more quid than we do.
Yeah. Well, sure. But they're the Rolling Stones. So fair play.
Courses, Nick, do you want to just quickly highlight the courses that you have that you still maintain, as you said?
Sure. Yep. There's Dive Into Docker, which is diveintodocker.com. That's more like a ground zero getting started with Docker. I have another like build a SaaS app with flask.com that's using Flask just to build all sorts of different, you know, SaaS apps that you may want to build. It uses Stripe, et cetera, et cetera. But yeah, all the details about everything will be on my main site, which is nickjanetakis.com. You know, nickjanetakis.com.
Perfect.
Not an easy one.
Seems like you've had to spell it before in your life. Yeah.
A few times.
Super.
Nice. Great. Well, Nick, thank you for coming on again. It's always great to catch up.
Yeah,
on
really enjoyed
things.
It. Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks a lot, guys. This was really fun. Hopefully in 2 years or less, maybe I'll come on again.
Super. You're always welcome.
Sounds good. Well, we are at djangochat.com and we'll see everyone next time. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.